And thank you for the introduction. And Jess is right. I will be talking about fluctuation theorems and entropy production. Entropy production is actually a concept of thermodynamics. And just to make sure that we're all on the same page, that we really know what we're talking about, let me start out with classical thermodynamics, or classic thermodynamics. Thermodynamics is a phenomenological theory of heat and work. The things that you're typically interested in are not microscopic dynamics, but the thermodynamic behavior of averages of observables, in particular heat and work. Nevertheless, thermodynamics is a tremendously powerful theory, which is universally valid on basically all length scales. So we know that you can apply ideas of thermodynamics to phase transitions, which is really at the micro scale. But you also can describe chemical reactions, stability of chemical processes. And you can go up all the way to astrophysics and think about the thermodynamics of the universe or the entropy of a black hole. Nevertheless, thermodynamics is actually a misleading title. So thermal, okay, that refers to heat and work. That's something that we understand. But dynamics actually refers to processes. If you say thermodynamics, you're actually lying. Because the only processes that are fully describable by means of thermodynamics are quasi-static processes. Quasi-static processes are a succession of equilibrium states, which means you're talking about processes that are infinitely slow. The only thing that thermodynamics can tell you about finite time processes, non-equilibrium processes, is that there's some non-equilibrium entropy production. We don't know much about the non-equilibrium entropy production. Everything that we know is that it's non-negative if you really have a finite time process. So you have to pay a thermodynamic price, but you don't know what. The purpose of thermodynamics is to understand and improve thermodynamic devices. Imagine that you have a heat engine, and you want to understand and derive what is the maximally extractable work. Well, you have a specific purpose, and you want to do that most efficiently. In order to do that, what you have to do is you have to minimize dissipation. You have to minimize your losses. And that actually means that you have to minimize this non-equilibrium entropy production, for which you don't actually have an expression from thermodynamics. Come on. Oh, that works. It's just covered a little bit by the edge. No, classical thermodynamics was developed for steam engines and car engines. What you see here in this plot is the typical dissipation rate, which is energy per second, versus the characteristic length scale. So if you look up here for steam engines and car engines, which are of the order of meters, they typically dissipate something like 10 to the, what is that, 2, 3, 6, 10, or kBT per second. Now, nowadays, we're a little bit more interested in nano devices. Nevertheless, we would like to actually apply ideas of thermodynamics, but that means that in this graph here, we get down to the dissipation rates of about 1 kBT per second and micro nanometer scales. What I show here is one of my favorite papers. So this is an experiment performed in 2003, where they created the first nano device that does something useful. Well, useful here means just that it rotates, and what you actually see is you have a small silica plate in a capacitor, which is attached to a carbon nanotube. The useful thing that you want to do is you want to make it rotate. And that's exactly what it does here. Now, if you actually take this artificial rotor in this diagram, then you're down here, which means you're down here at micrometers, and you're very, very close to the threshold of 1 kBT per second. Which means, if we want to understand the thermodynamic properties of these devices, what we actually have to do is we have to understand fluctuations. Because even a single kick from the environment, a single fluctuation, will drive the system generically far from equilibrium, which means we have to understand entropy production. The second motivation is that we're not only approaching the nanoscaling classical devices, but that we also actually have quantum devices that do something useful. And these quantum devices have properties which go even beyond the classical fluctuations. So what you see here is just what people call quantum Newton's cradle. I think that was actually one of the very first papers which I had to read when I started off my PhD. I really like this experiment. So what you have is this, you take a trap with a Bose-Einstein condensate, and then you just excite it with an AC voltage and pull the cloud apart. And what's going to happen is that the cloud starts oscillating. Now, if you wait, the typical classical time, which the system would need to relax into equilibrium, you will notice that the quantum system actually does not relax into the Boltzmann-Gibbs equilibrium state, but something else. And that's what you see here. So the condensate will happily oscillate back and forth, and will never reach, at least over the time scale that we are observing here, the thermodynamic equilibrium state. This is what's plotted over here. So these are the momentum distributions. So the dashed line is the Boltzmann-Gibbs distribution. I think the red line is the measurement. And the blue line is some numerical simulation. So we actually understand what's happening. If you have these bosons oscillating back and forth, well, the effective attractive interaction of the bosons actually make the bosons condensate back once the clouds meet. So we understand the mechanism. My point here is, if we have quantum devices, there are additional quantum fluctuations which change the thermodynamic behavior. And that's something that we have to understand. What we want to build is a thermodynamic descriptions of quantum nano devices, which generically operate far from thermal equilibrium. Now, that's the outline of my talk. I try to be very gentle. I try to be very introductory and just expose you to a couple of concepts to tell you what we're doing and what we're interested in. What I will start out with is the background. So I will tell you a little bit about the Yashinsky equality, which is a fluctuation theorem, which is a generalization of the second law for systems far from equilibrium. That has been done classically in quantum mechanically. And in order to illustrate how that actually works in quantum mechanics, I will apply the theory to something that we did most recently, which means we will generalize the Yashinsky equality to PT symmetric quantum mechanics. As far as I understand, that's a joint seminar for condensed matter people and quantum information people and, I don't know, a little bit of quantum foundation. And the first part will probably mostly be appealing to the quantum condensed matter people. In the second part, I will generalize the two-time energy measurement approach to arbitrary measurements. So I will show you how fluctuation theorems actually generalize if you're not in the thermodynamic limit, but if you really talk quantum mechanics. And I will try to convince you that the concept of fluctuation theorems is also useful in quantum information theory. So this part will be for the quantum information people. If I have time, I will conclude the talk by showing you how you actually can think about entropy production for a generic quantum system in quantum phase space. And this is what we're doing down here. And here I will talk about the definition of entropy production along trajectories, actually along Feynman path in phase space. And that might be interesting for hopefully everyone, but in particular for people from quantum foundations. Okay, let's get started. Now, the second law tells you how much work is extractable from a quantum system. You know that the total work performed by any system during an isothermal process is always larger equal the free energy difference. Now, the problem is if you have a generic process, it doesn't actually tell you by how much you're overshooting the free energy difference. The major breakthrough of Chris Yashinsky was to show that if you want to calculate the free energy, everything that you have to do is to take an average of the exponential work over an ensemble of realizations of the same process, and then you actually get an equality. That's what people call a fluctuation theory. Now, the difference between work and free energy, that's the irreversible work. So that's the amount of work that's lost into dissipation. Now, what you see here is that we really have to talk about fluctuations. So we're talking about averages over many realizations of the same process, and fluctuating quantity like work, they will have different values for different realizations. That actually means if we want to calculate differences of thermodynamic potentials like the free energy difference, then we have to know something about fluctuations, which means we have to know the probability distribution. So instead of only thinking about average values, like in classic conventional thermodynamics, we have to think about fluctuations and probability distributions. The Yashinsky equality is amazing because it's actually a theorem that's valid for any kind of processes, for slow processes, fast processes. It holds true for any kind of systems, closed systems, open systems, arbitrarily strongly coupled systems to the environment, non-Markovian processes. And it's really a generalization of their second law, because the second law, which says that the irreversible work is always non-negative for finite time processes, is a simple consequence of the Yashinsky equality. It just follows from the convexity of the exponential. Now, this theorem, or theorems, is actually a bunch of them, have been checked experimentally. And the reason why I'm showing you that is because I want to point out how you actually apply thermodynamics at the nanoscale and what you have to look out for. In this experiment, what they did is they took an RNA strand, which was clamped between optical tweezers, and these are some micrometer sized beads. Now, what they do in biophysics is they take this RNA strand and pull. Why do they do that? Well, they're interested in the internal structure of these molecules. So all these loops that you see here have some biological chemical function, and biologists, biophysicists are interested in these functions. In order to learn something about the functions, they have to learn something about the structure. Now, the structure is typically characterized by the free energy landscape. So there's a certain amount of thermodynamic energy, free energy, thermodynamic price associated with breaking one of these loops. So if you know the free energy landscape of this molecule, you actually know the structure of the molecule. Now, what they usually have to do is they have to pull arbitrarily slow, which means infinitely slow, in order to get a proper structural analysis. For that, they usually hire PhD students, but also PhD students have to graduate at some point, so pulling infinitely slow just doesn't work. So they needed a better tool. And the Yashinsky equality is exactly this tool, because it allows you to calculate the free energy difference from an ensemble of finite time processes. So how does it look? Over here you see a sketch of a typical measurement trace, and here the blue curve, so what you see is this force against length of the molecule, and if you pull very, very slowly, then you get something like the blue curve, which means if you unfold and refold, forward and backward process are identical, reversible, and that means that the work that has been performed during that process is actually the free energy difference. Now, if you do it fast, then you will see this hysteresis, so something happens, refolding and unfolding is not identical, so it's not reversible, and you can characterize equilibrium from non-equilibrium processes.
Are all those points averages?
No, that's a single trace. That's a single realization.
Okay. And, but it has to be averaging a little bit, right? Because when you're dragging it through there, like the that hysteresis loop is because there's a kink in the DNA or whatever.
Yeah, so the folding, refolding
so
happens
that
a different
must be
one.
Happening, right? But
so actually, so this is only one trace for a finite time process. Mm-hmm. And if you looked into traces for several realizations, this hysteresis will not fall on top of each other. You actually get a zoo of such kind of traces. And you actually see here the raggedness of the curve. That's the thermal fluctuations. And whenever the thermal fluctuation somehow kicks you into, so that's the unfolding and the refolding process. So let's look here. So if the thermal fluctuation kicks back into the loop, then this refolding happens either earlier or later. Now what you see down here is the work calculated from that stuff as a function of the extension. Now if you look at the red curves, these are the different work values that have been measured, and the thickness of the curve just illustrates the stochastic weight. So that's some kind of histogram. The more often a work value has been observed, the thicker the line. So that has been observed very often. That has been observed quite rarely. In green, you see the reversible work for the blue curve that's here. And in blue, you see the Yashinsky equality, and you see that it's fulfilled to, well, pretty good precision, up to whatever happens back here. Well, what happens back here is that means that the extension, the length of the molecule is very long, and at some point you just start ripping it apart. So the reason why I'm showing you that is well, on the one hand, the nanoscale fluctuations are important. That's one lesson to take away from here. And the other lesson is that thermodynamics for classical nano devices works pretty much like thermodynamics at the macro scale. Work is still given by force along some displacement. Now, in quantum systems, that's a problem, because quantum trajectories somehow lose their proper notion. It's not like you can take a quantum system and just measure along a path in phase space and then assign a work. So what you actually have to do is just you have to find a notion of quantum work that relies really on quantum mechanics and not on these classical notions. In the simplest case, you just consider isolated systems. For isolated systems, you know that the change of internal energy has to be work, that's the first law of thermodynamics, because no heat has been exchanged with the environment because there's no environment. Which means, and that's what people call the two-time energy measurement approach, if you want to determine quantum work, what you do is this, you take a projective energy measurement in the beginning, then you let your system evolve on a unitary dynamics, and at the end of the process, you take a second, final projective measurement of the energy. The difference of energy eigenvalues, that's exactly the work that has been performed for one single realization of the process. That's what we have here. Then if you want to build the probability distribution, you have to average over all possible realizations, which means you have to average over the initial state and over the transition probabilities, which are induced by the unitary dynamics. Make sense? Okay. Now, once you have this probability distribution for the work, you can calculate the Yashinsky quality, which means you just calculate the exponential of the work. What you see within two lines is really almost trivial. It's a two-liner. You can show that there is a Yashinsky quality, but this Yashinsky quality has a little bit of a strange form, because so classically, you would expect that these two Hamiltonians are actually in the same exponent. However, the H here means Heisenberg representation. However, what you get quantum mechanically is the product of two exponentials with respect to the Hamiltonian. And since the Hamiltonian does not have to commute with itself, you cannot just simply combine these two exponentials. The conclusion that has been drawn from this result is that quantum work is not an observable in the classical sense, which means there is no Hermitian operator whose eigenvalues are the classical work values. That makes sense, because work is actually a process-dependent quantity. Work depends on the path that has been taken by the system. However, Hermitian observables can be associated with state functions, which only depend on one point in time, which means that all thermodynamic quantities that we're usually interested in, work, entropy production, I should say, heat, cannot be assigned an Hermitian operator, and it's a little bit more complicated. Nevertheless, at least for isolated systems, what we have here is a conceptual simple notion of quantum work. So everything that you have to do is just measure the energy. But however, you already see that if you run into more complicated systems, like open systems, this approach has to fail. And this is what my talk is about. So what we have is a generalized statement of the second law. We have replaced an inequality by an equality, which is called a fluctuation theorem. However, the approach, as beautiful as it is and as powerful as it is for classical systems, only works for isolated quantum systems. Which means if we want to talk about more generic cases, open quantum systems, we need something better. Now, what we actually want is, it's not only something better, but actually something that's experimentally relevant. So thermodynamics is about devices, something that you actually can work with. Of course, you can write down all kinds of mathematical theories, but that's not what thermodynamics is about. Thermodynamics is about something useful. So if you want to talk about quantum work, we actually need a notion that you would be able to measure in an experiment. And where you want to start is this, well, you actually want to start with systems that are somehow simple. Now, in the next part of the talk, I will show you how the two-time energy measurement approach that I just introduced actually generalizes to systems which are, on the one hand, experimentally accessible, and on the other hand, not as boring as usual isolated Hermitian quantum mechanics. And what I will be talking about is pt-symmetric quantum mechanics, which are, to a certain degree, thermally isolated systems, which means you still have Hamiltonian dynamics, but they're not fully isolated because the Hamiltonian is no longer Hermitian. They can be understood as systems with balance loss or gain. Think about fluxes, gradients, temperature gradients, or voltages along electric wires. Actually, when I started out with this project, I thought pt-symmetric quantum mechanics is just a mathematical obscure theory with no relation to reality whatsoever. Although I had to learn that it actually has relation to reality, because over the last, I think, 5 years or so, all kinds of interesting experiments have been performed, for example, in microwave billets, photonic lattices, optical lattices, metamaterials, optical waveguides, and so on and so forth, which means pt-symmetric quantum mechanics actually plays a role in real physical systems. Okay, what is pt-symmetric quantum mechanics? So you're all familiar with Hermitian quantum mechanics. Hermitian quantum mechanics means that all operators, in particular the Hamiltonian, is Hermitian, which means, well, they're self-adjoint, and there's a representation where on the diagonal you have only the real numbers, which means all eigenvalues are real. Now, what Bender and Berthier did in 1998, oh, there's a funny anecdote which I forgot to tell you. So the Yashinsky equality was derived in 1997 in Los Alamos. Just across the hallway, Bender and Berthier derived pt-symmetric quantum mechanics in 1998 in Los Alamos. And this project, for the first time, actually put these theories together, which developed completely independently, but were derived right next to each other. And I think it was even the same building. OK. Now, pt-symmetric quantum mechanics replaces the condition of Hermitian Hamiltonians by the condition that the Hamiltonian only has to commute with the parity reflection operator and the time reflection operator. Now, the tricky part is that the time reflection operator is antilinear, because I is the imaginary unit, and the time reflection operator performs a complex conjugate on the imaginary unit. This has some quite interesting consequences. On the one hand, there's a huge class of these pt-symmetric Hamiltonians whose eigenvalue spectrum is completely real, which means these Hamiltonians actually induce unitary dynamics, but they're not Hermitian. That's what people call the unbroken regime of pt-symmetric quantum mechanics. On the other hand, most of these Hamiltonians actually show something like a phase transition, which means they have a parameter regime where the eigenvalues are complex and real. Yep.
So this is linear algebra. I think about Hermitian operators as orthogonal eigenvectors with real eigenvalues.
Yep.
They all have eigenvalues real. These are like Hamiltonians, but their eigenvectors are skewed.
Yep.
Cool.
This is exactly the point. So, well, quantum mechanics actually tells you, so if you look into the theorems of quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics tells you that physical states are represented by vectors in Hilbert space, and that and this Hilbert space, these vectors evolve under unitary dynamics. Now, these pt-symmetric Hamiltonians induce unitary dynamics because they have real eigenvalue spectrums. Physical states are still represented by vectors in Hilbert space, but there is no theorem in quantum mechanics, in standard quantum mechanics, that actually tells us with which inner product we have to equip the Banach space in order to get a Hilbert space. What you now have to do is this, and that's exactly what he said, well, you have to somehow properly set up the inner product to get the orthogonality back. And this is what we have to do. So the inner product in this Hilbert space is defined via this metric operator, which makes just sure that the absolute square within this inner product of the wave function is still a proper probability density. This C, this is a little bit of suggestive notation, because that's something like the charge conjugate operator in field theories. So that's nothing weird. And the metric operator, at least in the unbroken regime, is very, very simply constructed from this commutation relation and normalization.
C is going to appear in what you do? Or is that?
Yeah, it's going to appear. Well, the inner product is going to appear, and you will see in a second why. Yep.
Does the unbroken and broken regime correspond to isolated and open systems, or not necessarily?
Not necessarily, no.
Okay.
So the broken system, in the broken regime, actually something more happens. And you will see in a second that what I'm trying to do is this. I'm trying to apply a theory that works for isolated systems to systems which are not quite isolated. And you will see that it works in the unbroken regime, which means we still have clear thermodynamic notions for the unbroken regime, and that the approach completely fails in the broken regime, which means we don't have thermodynamics for the broken regime anymore. OK. Now, there's one more ingredient. So what you saw in the previous slide is this.
Sorry, I have one more.
Yeah, sure.
Complex eigenvalues, is that going to be some sort of loss of probability?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Exactly, and that's what you're going to see on the next slide.
Right.
Okay, the most important part on this slide is actually the metric operator. So you see that it's defined in terms of the Hamiltonian. If the Hamiltonian is time dependent, Also, the metric operator has to be time dependent, which means the topology of the Hilbert space changes since the topology is induced by the Hamiltonian. Which means if you want to write down the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, you have to make up for the change of the metric space, which means you have to include an additional gauge field. And that's something that has been shown beautifully in this very mathematical paper. Now, if you get the time-dependent Schrödinger equation just right with this gauge field, then you can define the transition probabilities from initial state m to final state n. Now, in usual Hermitian quantum mechanics, it's very simple because it's just the matrix elements of the propagator, of the unitary evolution operator. Now, here it becomes a little bit more complicated because you actually have to account for the metric operator and the parity and time reflection operators. So that's this monster. It's actually not particularly complicated. So the U here is just the solution of the Schrödinger equation. And then you have to make sure that you put the right metric at the right points. One note of caution, so that's actually a non-commuting product. So the order plays a role. So what you have here is you measure the system in the beginning. So you project into the mth energy eigenstate. So that's a product of the initial density operator with the initial eigenstate with the right metric. Then you evolve the system under unitary dynamics and project that into the final energy eigenstate. Now, in complete analogy to what you would do in Hermitian quantum mechanics, and that's probably the only derivation that I'm going to show you in the whole talk, is that you calculate the average of the exponential. So you take the probability distribution that I showed you on the previous slide. There was a delta function of the work minus the difference in energy eigenvalues times the probability distribution. Now, if you play around a little bit with normalization, you just get one over the partition function, and you are left with this term here. Now, the reason why I'm writing this down is because here you will beautifully see why thermodynamics works for the unbroken regime and why it fails for the broken regime. Now, something that we in quantum thermodynamics know very well is that fluctuation theorems are only valid if the dynamics is at least unital. Unital means that the trace-specific completely positive map associated with the dynamics maintains unity, the identity operator. And this is what you see here. Now, if the eigenvalue spectrum of the Hamiltonian is completely real, then this is actually a proper unitary dynamics, which means this is just the CTP representation of the unity operator at time tau, the identity operator at time tau. Which means for the unbroken regime, you immediately get Yashinsky, because that all falls out. Then you get the partition function at time tau, which means you get the the ratio of partition functions, which is not the exponential of the free energy. In the broken regime, since you have complex eigenvalues, the evolution is no longer unitary, which means the fluctuation theorem is not fulfilled, which means we don't have a proper notion of the second law, which means we don't have proper thermodynamics. Okay, let's do that in an example. Before I go into the math, this is a very, very simple system which shows PT symmetry, and where you actually can study the difference between Hermitian quantum mechanics and PT symmetric quantum mechanics. What these people did is instead of actually looking into a real quantum system, they looked into an equivalent system in optics. Now, what you have is you have two pumped optical waveguides, where only one of the waveguides is optically pumped, the other one is decoupled from the pumping, but they're close enough that they actually interact. In the Hermitian case, you get something like this. That's the density profile of the field strength. In the PT symmetric case, and that's something that you get realized by just playing around with the coupling strength, which means you pull the optical waveguides apart to put them together, you see that the PT symmetric case still looks very much the same like the Hermitian system, but these peaks are a little smeared out. In the broken case, something completely crazy happens. What you see is that only one of, and here's actually only the pumped waveguide, shows a non-vanishing density, whereas the other guide is completely dark. And that makes sense. So if you're pumping your system too strongly, the interaction cannot keep up. which means the other, the second waveguide is completely left out. Now, why are we looking into the system? Because the mathematical treatment is so simple. It's just a two-level system. The evolution equation, it's not really the evolution equation, but the density profile of the field amplitudes is determined by this system of two-couple differential equations. Now, what you see here is that it looks exactly like a Schrödinger equation, time-independent Schrödinger equation, where the evolution, the time variable, is frozen along the waveguide, where the C component is the time. That's actually great because you can study quantum mechanics without actually having let it run anything, because the whole evolution is frozen in the amplitude profile over the waveguide. In particular, you see that the Hamiltonian is just given by this very, very simple two-level Hamiltonian, which has these energy eigenvalues. Now, what you see here is that if this alpha, which is the ratio of the coupling coefficient over the pumping coefficient, is smaller than 1, then you have a completely real eigenvalue spectrum. If you're pumping too fast, or too much, too strongly, then the coupling between the two waveguides cannot keep up, and the eigenvalues become actually purely imaginary. Now, you can go through the whole analysis, you can calculate everything, and just see what happens. What I'm plotting you here is the irreversible work, remember, work minus free energy difference, for a linear driving. Linear driving makes sense because everything that it would do is you would take the two waveguides and just pull them apart. You have to make sure that you use the proper generalized time-dependent Schrödinger equation, which means you have the density field, the gauge field, and the whole dynamics would again be frozen also for the time-dependent process in the waveguide. Now, what you see here is on the left-hand side, the situation where you start your system in the unbroken regime. Here in the inset, you see the Yashinsky equality, and you see that it works. So the right-hand side is indeed 1. Yashinsky is numerically verified for the system. That's great, but so what? That's the reason why I plotted the irreversible work, work minus free energy, so the exponent up here, as a function of this coupling coefficient, the final value of this parameter alpha. Now, what you see is this, well, in the beginning, not much happens because you're not driving the system far. And the closer you get to the critical point where the unbroken regime breaks down and you actually enter the broken regime, the more irreversible work you have to pay. Now, this is not a surprise. I don't know if anyone of you is familiar with quantum phase transitions, but in quantum phase transitions, we know that the susceptibilities actually diverge at the critical point. It has been argued that in quantum phase transitions, the irreversible work can be associated with a susceptibility. So the divergence is actually what you would expect from a quantum phase transition. However, in usual quantum phase transitions, the susceptibilities come back. It's just a singularity. Here in this case, the irreversible work disappears to infinity and never comes back. It actually stays at infinity. The way to interpret that is that the phase transition from the unbroken into the broken regime is thermodynamically inhibited, which just means that we don't have a thermodynamic theory for the broken regime, and something has to break down, which means the irreversible work cannot come back because we don't even have a clear notion of irreversible work for the broken regime. To illustrate this point, I also plotted on the left-hand side exactly the same quantities, but for a process that actually starts in the broken regime. Remember, in the broken regime, the energy eigenvalues are already imaginary, which means that the difference of eigenvalues actually will have real and imaginary part. This already gives you a feeling of we don't have clear thermodynamics because what is a complex energy? This is what you see here. Nevertheless, you see that also the absolute value, I think that's real part and that's imaginary part. You see that the absolute value also diverges, which means the closer you get from the critical point from either direction, the theory breaks down. Also, of course, the Yashinsky equality is not fulfilled because you again have real part and imaginary part and they do something crazy. Okay, now this is nice. I hope I could convince you that PT symmetric systems are actually interesting. You can do interesting thermodynamics. And I hope that I gave you a little bit of a flavor of what the two-time energy measurement actually means. Now what I want to do next is I want to move on. I want to go a little bit away from these PT symmetric systems and tell you how you actually could generalize the approach to something where you can't measure the energy anymore. And that's what we want to be talking about, are generalizations. So we started with an initial thermostate in order to do thermodynamics. Now, in a typical quantum information theory setup, you wouldn't prepare your system in a thermostate, in a canonical equilibrium. Why would you do that? You would rather think about coherent states or pure states, which means we actually have to account for corrections that come from the initial state. Then the dynamics typically won't be unitary. You will have some arbitrary TCP map. TCP is trace preserving completely positive. I don't know what your favorite acronym is, which means we have to replace the unitary dynamics with some general, doesn't have to be time evolution, but with some general evolution. Also, measuring the energy is probably not what you want to do. Depending on the process or depending on what you want to do in the lab, you want to measure something else, maybe angular momentum or choose the favorite observable, which means we have to account for corrections that come from arbitrary measures. And that also means that we actually, if we want to use these ideas of fluctuation theorems, we have to replace notions such as work, heat, with entropy and information production. So how does it work? This is just a little bit of a reminder. You're probably all familiar with that. But if you, so far I've been talking about projective energy measurements. And what we want to do is now we want to talk about general measurements. For the sake of simplicity, I formulate everything in terms of projectors, but they don't have to be projectors. It can be some arbitrary POVM, positive operator value measurement. So you know that if you have a quantum state and you measure in a specific observable, then what happens is that you project, at least for this projector, the quantum state into the eigenspace of the projector. That's something like the collapse of the wave function, which means that's something that you already see here. If the eigenvalue, if the density operator does not commute of the measurement, then you will have a back action. And in the business of fluctuation theorems, you will have to account for this measurement back action. Then you know that the statistics of the measured quantum system is actually given by the superposition of all these projectors. And well, I really want to emphasize this again. So if observable and density operator do not commute, then you have to account for something. There will be a correction. This is something which people have never thought about, because in thermodynamics, what I showed you before, systems are generically prepared in thermal states, which means in Gibbs states, which of course commute with the energy measurement. If you have arbitrary states and arbitrary observables, this won't be the case anymore. The second thing that we have to account for are arbitrary time evolutions, and I want to formulate that in terms of trace preserving completely positive maps. Well, you know that this is any linear quantum transformation that you can think of, and everything that this complicated TCP or CPTP actually means is that density operators are mapped onto density operators. So we want to maintain and conserve normalization. These evolutions can be interpreted as measurements that are performed by the environment on the system. This is interesting because that actually means the initial measurement and the evolution can be treated on the same conceptual footing. We also know that the dynamics are not necessarily reducible to differential equations, and you have to be a little bit careful if you actually have something like a time evolution. But that's probably something that you're anyways familiar with from quantum information theory. Just for completeness, well, how do these evolutions actually look? Well, they look very much like the measurements that I had on the previous slide. And these case are here are called cross operators. Now, what can you do with that? Let's really generalize the procedure that I tried to motivate in the thermodynamic setup. So we take projective measurement in the beginning of some arbitrary observable. Then we let the system evolve under some dynamics, under some TCP map, and then we take a second final projective measurement of the observable. Then the difference of eigenvalues becomes a random observable, for which we can write down the probability distribution in complete analogy to what we had in the thermodynamic case. That's what we have here. However, in this case, the transition probability, remember that was a huge complicated product that I had to account for the metric in the PT symmetric case. Now looks a little different, where I have all these projectors in here. But it has exactly the same physical meaning. So I start with some initial density operator. I take an initial measurement Then I evolve it under some TCP map, and then I take a second measurement. With that, I can build exactly the same probability distribution and just see if there's something like a fluctuation theorem, if I get the same structure. But that's what we did in this paper here. And what you see is, well, you get pretty much the same structure, but the right-hand side is not one anymore. You get a correction factor. Now, this correction factor is not too surprising, because this correction factor actually accounts for all the issues that I already itemized, which means if your measurement does not commute with your initial state, you have to account for the back action. And if the dynamics is not at least unital, which means the identity operator is not conserved under the dynamics, you get an additional back action. And this is what's encoded in here. Now, the funny thing is that in the setup of thermodynamics with information processing, similar fluctuation theorems have been derived where this right-hand side has been called efficacy, which just means that this right-hand side measures how well the procedure actually performs on a specific process. And this is exactly the same physical idea behind this quantum efficacy, the right-hand side of the fluctuation theorem that we're writing down here. The right-hand side measures how well the procedure performs given in a specific initial state and given a specific dynamics. Now you can do all kinds of interesting things, or you can try again to do some thermodynamics, which means you choose thermodynamic observables, a thermodynamic TCP map, and just see what happens and look into the entropy production. However, also so this Jensen's inequality, that means from the convexity of the exponential, you get this kind of inequalities. And you see, it smells already very much like formulations of the second law, where some entropy production or some work is always larger than some free energy difference. From a quantum information theoretic point of view, and this is actually what we did in this paper, we argued that this inequality is very mathematical, this inequality. But nevertheless, the approach is very useful, because what we did is that you can derive all kinds of inequalities in information theory by means of this fluctuation theorem. And in particular, we showed that if you get your observables right, you get a very neat two-line proof of Holevo's bond. And that's in here. However, I would like to emphasize that from a thermodynamic point of view, this is not really a fluctuation theorem, although I actually called it a fluctuation theorem in 2012, because it doesn't really tell you anything about thermodynamics. Only if you choose your observables right, and you get the dynamics right, you actually have a thermodynamic setup. Okay. Now, for 40 minutes or so, I've been talking about two-time measurement approaches. You saw that it actually works, so the two-time energy measurement approach has some benefits. You can describe isolated systems, you can describe quasi-open systems like the pt-symmetric quantum systems. But it doesn't really go particularly far, especially from a thermodynamic point of view. For example, the first issue is, well, for these fluctuation theorems, you always had to assume that the system was initially prepared in a Boltzmann-Gibbs distribution in a canonical equilibrium. However, we know, for example, from quantum Brownian motion, that a system will not generically relax into a Gibbs equilibrium state, but there will be a correction term that comes from the commutation relation of the reduced Hamiltonian of the system of interest and the interaction with the environment. Quantum mechanically, a thermodynamic system of interest is generically correlated with the environment. And you have to account for this. And I just showed you that the two-time energy measurement approach is not completely sufficient to do thermodynamics, because you have all these measurement back actions, and you have to think very carefully about what you actually can do. In particular, if you have an open system, and that's something that I have completely neglected so far, then the energy difference is not pure work. You actually have to distinguish between work and heat. That's already complicated classically, but at least classically, you still can make the case that work is something like force along a displacement. Quantum mechanics doesn't work anymore. So how the hell are you supposed to distinguish between work and heat? The simplest solution that we could come up with is, well, we know that heat is the amount of energy that's been exchanged with the thermal environment. So if you just take projective measurements of the system of interest, which will tell us something about the change of internal energy of the system, and projective energy measurements in the environment, which has to be heat because no work is performed on the environment, then we can clearly distinguish between heat and work. Now imagine what would happen if you walked into the lab of an experimentalist and asked him, please take a projective energy measurement on the rest of the universe. If he only laughs at you, you're probably lucky. But this is not going to work, so we need something better. And over the last, well, the first reference, 2012, over the last 3 to 4 years, there has been a huge activity in trying to generalize fluctuation theorems to open quantum systems, which goes away from this idea of measurements, but with the expense of having to define new notions of quantum work and quantum entropy production. Now, the easiest thing that you can do, and that's something that I already alluded to, is instead of actually trying to define an experimentally accessible work, let's just define a quantity along a trajectory, a Feynman path, that looks like the classical work, and see how far we can go. That, of course, means that we cannot measure work along a single realization, but at least the average should be right. And this is something that has been done by Yitsubashi and Beilo Ku. And I think these are two guys which you should know because they frequently come here. But they weren't the only ones. Also in these papers here, there's some form of quantum trajectory approach. However, there's Yeet and Beilo looked into quantum trajectory in configuration space, Feynman path. These guys defined quantum entropy production along trajectories in Hilbert space, which means you follow the wave function, and every now and then you allow for a stochastic jump. Very successful. However, all of these two notions are not experimentally relevant. Now it gets even a little crazier. So what Michele Campisi did here is he said, OK, let's just completely forget about what we actually can measure. Let's just see if we can get the structure of thermodynamics from quantum mechanics. And what he does in this new Journal of Physics article is to show that there are fluctuation theorems that can be derived from ensembles of wave functions. It's not quite clear what that actually means thermodynamically, physically, practically, but he can show that the structure of fluctuation theorems just pops out rather automatically. Now, this paper here is very mathematical. It's very hard to read. Where Armin showed that, well, if you want to define quantum work and the two-time energy measurement approach doesn't really work, maybe we have to come up with new notions of probabilities. So what he actually showed us is that you can define something like quantum work that's based on the Hausdorff-Stückelberg measure. And to be honest, I still don't quite understand the paper because I was not familiar with this measure before I read the manuscript. On the next two or three slides, I will tell you a little bit about what I did. And for that, I would like to go back to the classical notion of work. In classical mechanics, and this is the reason why I showed you the experiment, thermodynamics at the nanoscale still works pretty much like at the macroscale. Quantum work is a force along a displacement. Now, everything that we've been doing was throwing around heavy quantum machinery, but we were very, very far removed from the original ideas of classical mechanics. Now, what we're thinking is, okay, now the space that we actually should be interested in thermodynamics is phase space. Now, if you could come up with a notion of entropy production in quantum phase space, then maybe, again, like in the other papers, we cannot actually measure entropy production or work along a single trajectory, but maybe we can assign physical meaning to the average and get thermodynamics right. Now, for various reasons, I chose to represent phase space in Wigner representation. You can argue if that makes any sense, but at least the Wigner representation makes it particularly easy to work with. Then I assumed that you have some arbitrary master equation which has a stationary solution. That's already a pretty strong assumption. But if I want to do thermodynamics, I at least need a stationary state. If I don't even have a stationary solution, I don't even know how to come up with thermodynamics. And I need some time evolution. Then you can define an entropy production which looks like this. So gamma is actually a path in Wigner phase space. And this looks very much like the entropy production that you would see in classical thermodynamics. Now, if this stationary solution is actually a Boltzmann-Gibbs distribution, which is just the y symbol e to the minus beta h, then everything that you get here is the classic thermodynamic work. Well, generically, the stationary solution will be something else, will be more complicated. But nevertheless, this is something like an information entropy production, which does the job. Now, one should emphasize that these trajectories in a phase space are something like Feynman path, but it's nothing that you really can measure. Yep. That's an external control parameter. So think of something like the piston, or the volume of the piston that you can change, or a little spring that you can put mass on. And that's a thermodynamic external control variable. Yep, okay, so these trajectories are something like Feynman path. So a single trajectory is not accessible. Nevertheless, we want to assign physical meaning to the average value, which means we want to assign physical meaning to this entropy production. Now, how does the derivation go? So I actually lied to you. There's a second derivation, and that's this one. But it's also very, very simple. So what you want to write down is the joint distribution for the point in phase space, the accumulated entropy production up to a certain time. L is the Liouvillean of the master equation. And this guy here, that's the quasi-probability flux. Now, as you see, it's just the integrand. So it's not really a surprise. And that just tells you how the probability changes over time, which means how the entropy is produced over time. Then what you have to do is this, you have to calculate the exponentially weighted marginal. Why do you do that? Well, you want to get a fluctuation theorem. So you're typically interested in the average of the exponential. And it turns out, well, that thing is a stationary solution that you get within two lines of fluctuation theorem. This is nice, but so what? There are a couple of lessons to learn here. The first lesson is, well, fluctuation theorems are a bit more generic than you would actually think. As long as you have a normalizable probability distribution, which means as long as you have a normalized measure on a manifold, you will always find the structure of fluctuation theorems. The job for us physicists is to find the entropy productions that actually have physical meaning. What I could show in an example, I don't know if I have that here. No, I don't have it here. Is that this entropy production in the semi-classical limit actually reduces to the thermodynamic work. So that's a plus. However, the representation of Wigner, representation of phase space, quantum phase space, is not unique, which means depending on the representation that you choose, you will get different thermodynamics. And the question is, well, if you want to talk to an experimentalist, and now I'm coming back to my original point, thermodynamics is about devices, something practically useful. What we actually have to do is this, we have to find representations of thermodynamics that are experimentally relevant and can be applied directly. But this is an open problem and people are working on it. Now, I guess my time is over. And I vomited a lot of concepts at you, which you're probably not completely familiar with. And there was a lot of thermodynamics and a lot of different ideas. So I know the talk is videotaped, so you can actually go back. But I don't think that you actually have time to watch my talk. So if you walk out here, I only have three very, very simple messages that I would like you to take home. One, I showed you that the second law of thermodynamics can be generalized to so-called fluctuation theorems. And these fluctuation theorems are identities, are theorems, which account for fluctuations at the nanoscale, classically and quantum mechanically. I told you a little bit about the two-time measurement approach and how that works for isolated systems and PT-symmetric quantum systems. The idea is, instead of actually following the whole trajectory, we just take measurements of observables in the beginning and in the end, and then reconstruct statistics from two-time observables. And then finally, I told you a little bit about quantum entropy production in phase space, which means that I exposed you a little bit to the fundamental questions that we're facing. Even though thermodynamics is almost 200 years old, we still don't know how to set up thermodynamics for open quantum systems, because we run into these fundamental problems that we have no idea whatsoever how to define a proper notion of quantum entropy production. Now, these are the papers which I cited along the way. So this one was the two-time energy measurement approach of system and environment. This one was the one with Olivos bond and quantum information theory. That one was the one with the entropy production in phase space. And this is on the PT symmetric quantum mechanics. Now, finally, that's only to show off. But this is really something that I want to do, is I want to acknowledge my collaborators. So Eric Lutz is my PhD advisor. He's now at I think it's called Friedrich Alexander University in Erlangen. De Vere is a very, very gifted PhD student in Maryland, University of Maryland in College Park. And Avad is my co-host in Los Alamos. Thank you. And then I have one more thing. So if you liked what I've been talking about, there will be a conference in Telluride in July. And it's not too late to register. We still have a little bit of space. And we will be aiming at exposing researchers from different areas, in particular from quantum information theory, from advanced metaphysics, statistical mechanics, quantum technologies, to ideas in different fields and bring together thermodynamics and information theory. Thank you.
Any questions? So I had one, was just kind of get what we're talking about here. So you have these definitions of entropy production when you're thinking about it in these nanoscales, when backpacking is a real problem. Do you have any idea of what this looks like as you take, you know, H bar to zero, as you go to larger systems, how does that reduce in the way that makes sense?
I never looked into the semi-classical limit. But the problem here is also that, so we only formulated that on a very, very abstract level in terms of these maps.
Right.
So I have no idea how to take the semi-classical limit of a TCP map.
Right.
But probably what you want to do is, and this might be interesting, and people have been looking into, actually, my former postdoc advisor, Chris Yersinski, he tried to come up with a correspondence principle. And here we're talking about a thermodynamic correspondence principle. Something that he didn't particularly like is that for quantum systems and for classical systems, work is defined fundamentally different. Which means in classical systems, you have this notion of an observable along a trajectory. And in quantum systems, you have this two-time energy measurements. What he showed us is that there's a correspondence principle, which means if you calculate the work distribution quantum mechanically and take the semi-classical limit h bar to zero, then you get the proper classical distribution. But this only works for isolated systems and energy measurements. I have no idea what happens if you have non-commuting observables. It might be interesting, but also probably very, very hard to work out. What I would rather suggest is that you take an approach like I did in the last part about the entropy production, you have that guy in phase space, where you already have a very well-controlled high temperature limit. So let's say you take something like a Caldera-Leggett master equation or the Hu-Pasang master equation or something like that, calculate the entropy production in this space, and then take the classical, and in this case, high temperature limit, and see what happens.
All right, thank you again.